All right, thank you. If you all could have a seat. The case we're hearing now is called Travelers Property Casualty Company versus Strusscom Corporation. Could I have the entry of appearances, please, counsel?
It's like our album, we were our review with me is Mr. Edwin Stevens and my colleague, also in brief.
Thank you. Counsel?
Good morning, Your Honor. Sean Conley, we have a respondent, Strusscom, this is Katie Mahal, of the argument today.
All right, very good. Thank you. Gentlemen, this is a one-hour case. You each have 30 minutes. You'll have to count down for yourself if you want to save any rebuttal time. Whenever you're ready, Mr. Wheeler.
Thank you. May it please the court.
Counsel.
At bottom, the question in this case is whether this court should severely limit a precedent that has soundly, clearly, and without controversy guided the public and the bar for more than 75 years. The answer is no. The Court of Appeals decision should be reversed. This court's decision enforcing the no voluntary payment provision in Kessinger without a prejudice limitation has withstood the test of time unchallenged precisely because it has helped citizens who need and want insurance to be able to obtain that insurance at affordable prices. And in doing so, it helps to ensure that people who are injured by tortfeasors are going to, in fact, be able to recover and get some compensation. The Court of Appeals acknowledged expressly that the rule that it announced conflicts with this court's opinion in Kessinger. And the way it got there was by misinterpreting and misapplying this court's decision in Freeland. I'd like to begin by quickly just outlining the six most important analytical errors that the trial court and the Court of Appeals made in comparing Freeland and using it in this case. First, late notice alone, as in Freeland, was the only issue that was addressed in Freeland. And it presents essentially zero risk of collusion, because there's no agreement between the insured and a third party that can be the source of collusion. In sharp contrast, as the facts in this case show, when you have a settlement agreement, it can be the result of all sources of collusion. So there's a much more severe risk of collusion in this instance than in those cases. Second, late notice by insurers presents zero risk of what economists and courts call moral hazard conduct. And by that, we mean conduct by which the insurer benefits himself or itself in this case in a way that is not at its expense, but at other insurers' expense. Late notice is always just an omission and is always, I should say nearly always, inadvertent. In sharp contrast, as the facts in this case show, an unauthorized settlement between an insured and a third party can be for a different purpose, namely to gain business or to preserve business. That is not the subject of the insurance. Third, late notice will usually be what this court in Freeland accurately called a technicality. The insured might miss the notice date by a day, by a week, even by a month, by 2 months. But it's a technicality, it's just a procedural issue. In stark contrast, when you have a no voluntary payment provision as here, and the insured violates it, it's an affirmative act, it's done intentionally, and in fact, in this case, it violates, it strips the insurer of two rights that are guaranteed in the coverage section of the policy, namely, the right to control the defense to defend, and the right to control settlement. Fourth, the no voluntary payment requirement directly guards against societally inflated settlements as a result of the insured's lack of experience, or lack of knowledge, or lack of expertise. That doesn't happen when you're simply talking about a late notice situation. Fifth, and very importantly, there is no windfall to the insurer when the insured violates a no voluntary agreement provision and settles the case without consent. Why is that? It's because for all the years before the event occurred, the insurance company was charging premiums on the basis of the Kessinger decision. The premiums took into account that there was a no voluntary agreement provision, that it would be strictly enforced, there would not be some exception. And now, all of a sudden, by the Court of Appeals ruling, the insurer is going to get a windfall. He's going to get compensation and then something beyond that when he didn't pay for that. That wasn't what the insurance provided for. So quite contrary to the situation in Freeland, not only does the insurer here not get a windfall, but the insurer does get a windfall.
Mr. Wheeler, may
I interject you? You're so close to having all six on the table. But I'm just wondering, how did Travelers suffer any actual prejudice as a result of StressCon settlement with Mortenson?
Absolutely. Because what happened is the Travelers has had to engage in this satellite litigation over the course of several years. This is exactly the kind of satellite litigation that Kessinger was intended to and did prevent. So it's the cost of having to be brought into court in order to deal with the kinds of allegations that are being made here by StressCon. So yes, it's very substantial prejudice.
Thank you.
And then the sixth major distinction is because of the multiple premium inflating effects of the no voluntary agreement prejudice rule that the Court of Appeals adopted, what it means is that many injured persons are going to go uncompensated or inadequately compensated because the prices of all insurance policies, liability insurance policies, are going to have to be raised to take exactly this kind of a problem into account. They're going to have to be raised to take into account the unpredictability of collusion, the unpredictability of moral hazard, the unpredictability of settlements that are inflated because of lesser experience or knowledge of the insurers. And that distinguishes this from Freeland in a very major way. So with that in mind, I now want to address, and StressCon, of course, is brief, really didn't contest any of those points. What StressCon did was to rely entirely on the assertion that Kessinger is distinguishable because there was no denial of the claim in Kessinger. Well, that's just wrong. We've submitted for this court the briefing from the Kessinger case, and it's clear that both from the letter that was sent in the Kessinger case and from the court's opinion and from the briefing that, in fact, there was a denial. There's no question that the insurer sent a request to the insurer asking for the insurer to step up. And the insurer, in that case, sent back a letter saying, we're not interested. That's denying that claim. But what the court found, what this court found as a matter of law, that the insurer did not do was to deny coverage. That's exactly what we have in this case. This case was tried by StressCon as a denial of a claim for payment, not a denial of coverage. And if we look at the verdict form and what the jury was asked to find, we see that the jury was not asked to find and did not find a denial of coverage. Just as in Kessinger, in this case, we have a situation in which the insured said, we think we should be paid as soon as we file the claim. That's the argument that the trial counsel made in opening statement. That's the argument that the trial counsel made in closing argument. They asked for an instruction on anticipatory breach, and they didn't get the instruction on anticipatory breach. So that claim, that argument, did not go to the jury.
I don't understand exactly what you're saying there. What is your point with respect to that?
The point is that before, so let me separate
Separate that out, maybe.
Right. Two very important time periods.
Okay.
There's before the unauthorized settlement in December of 2008, and there's afterwards. Travelers argued from the beginning, from summary judgment and all the way through the trial, that it had no duty to pay before the settlement because it had no duty at all. There was, the court ruled, the trial court ruled, the court appeals agreed. There was no duty to defend because there was no lawsuit filed. There was no duty to investigate because there was no lawsuit filed. And under this court's ruling in Cypress AMAX, we argued below, therefore there was no duty to pay either, no duty to indemnify. The trial court made a fundamental error in saying, no, I think the jury can find there was a duty to indemnify before December 2008. We said that the only way this case could be allowed to go to a jury to ask about breaches on an anticipatory breach theory, but there was no evidence for that. Stresscon asked for an anticipatory breach instruction, breach instruction, and didn't get one. And therefore, as the case went to the jury,
So then during opening arguments, what was said? They made that argument during opening.
They didn't make it.
Okay, that's where I got mixed up. So
right. They did not. That's my point. They tried the case from beginning to end, not as an anticipatory breach case. Their theory was their chairman testified that he thought that as soon as in October of 2007, as soon as Mortensen told Stresscon that it wanted to be compensated for the delays, at that point, that Travelers should have started paying, even though there was no lawsuit, even though there was no claim, there was no demand. That was the theory they argued all the way through. Their trial counsel on appeal, in fact, let me read this, because I don't think it's very important. This is at 19 minutes and 8 seconds. The court asked, what is Stresscon's position on the precise date upon which a benefit was denied, a benefit that was payable was denied? The answer was, legal obligation under the settlement was, that's inaudible, that's the end of December 2008. End of December 2008. He then said, counsel, there wasn't a legal obligation which could trigger a duty to pay until the settlement was entered into the court, so there couldn't have been a delay, or there could not have been a delay that happened until it happened, right? Answer, well, the delay came after that duty. The court, the delay came after, correct, Mr. Gunnell, and the denial came after. The point is that there was no denial of coverage before December 2008. So that claim should have been taken away from the jury. Under Kessinger, since the settlement was an improper settlement, it was not consented to, that claim should have been taken away from the jury, and therefore the court, the trial court, should have ruled in our favor. So it was the Kessinger, it was the trial court's misinterpretation of Kessinger that skewed the entire case from the beginning, and that then, and then the second major error the court made that finished it off was by, although the ruling, there was no duty to investigate, there was no duty to defend, because no claim, no lawsuit filed, there could be a duty to identify. But this court's decision in Cypress AMAX unequivocally says that the duty to identify cannot arise absent a judgment in favor of a settlement.
Mr. Wheeler, let me just ask you this. So when you say that it was the trial court's decision initially, is the logic then that's because the starting point, the trial judge made a mistake about the starting point because of its wrongful application of Kessinger? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
That the timing was wrong from thereafter.
From that point forward.
That's what you're arguing.
Exactly.
So could you, and I understand your argument, could you just walk me through those dates though one more time, please? Because that's something that I've had a little trouble figuring out.
Yes, I apologize for not giving something of a calendar here, because I know that will help. So the accident occurred in July of 2007.
Right.
In October of 2007, the general contractor, Mortensen, said to Stresscon, his subcontractor, we think that you should be paying us for some of the damages that we have incurred. later in February of 2008, Mortensen sent a itemization of what then claimed worst damages to StressCon, which 1 month later, in March of 2008, StressCon forwarded to Travelers. And that said, here's what we think our damages are at that time. They're contingent, we're still increasing the ability and could end up, but here's the claim that we're basically making. The trial court ruled that those events were sufficient to create a duty to pay, a duty to indemnify, even though there was no lawsuit filed. Travelers, on April 21st, 2008, sent a reservation of rights letter to its insured, StressCon, saying, here are some conditions that may mean that there's not going to be coverage. A typical classical reservation of rights letter. That letter was never revoked, that letter was never retracted, it was never modified in any way. It stayed in force all the way through to December 2008, when this unauthorized settlement occurred. Now, our position was and is that because there was no duty to indemnify at all until a lawsuit got filed, the StressCon could get around the fact that they breached the policy by entering into an unauthorized, unconsented to settlement in December of 2008 would be to prove that there was a revocation of the policy, namely a denial of coverage. There was no such proof, but more importantly, it wasn't pled, it wasn't instructed on, it wasn't in the verdict form, and there was no finding of it. So there's no basis in the anticipatory breach doctrine under Lake Durango for them to win on that theory. Therefore, there's literally no support for the judgment below. As to post-December of 2008, after the unauthorized, unconsented to breaching settlement agreement, nothing that happens after that makes any difference because they've now breached. That's the end of their rights under the contract. And I want to address one of the words that has come up in a couple of the court's opinions and that StressCon has relied on is that somehow this is a forfeiture of something that StressCon is entitled to. It's not a forfeiture, it's a waiver. StressCon entered into a contract that specifically said in the coverage provisions that it is the insurer that controls investigation, has discretion investigation, it's the insurer that controls someone. There is the no voluntary payment provision that emphasizes those. StressCon knew that. It chose to ignore those and enter into a settlement. Why did it do that? Their chief executive officer admitted on the stand, under oath, that he did in order to preserve his business and to get further business. And in fact, that's what the settlement agreement does. The settlement agreement ties in the payments that are to be made to future business that Mortensen is going to give to StressCon. This is exactly as Judge Posner said in Charlotte Rose. This is exactly the kind of conduct that you wouldn't expect. In fact, he said that insurance company would be foolhardy to provide insurance for that kind of conduct because that's so unpredictable. You don't know what it is. It's insurance to preserve business and get additional business. There's never been a policy written for that, and there never will be. So, if we look at the findings that the jury made in the verdict, we see no mention of denial of coverage. We see no mention of renunciation. We see no mention of anticipatory breach. All we see is a failure to pay. And if it's failure to pay before 2008, there's no duty to pay, so that's not a violation of the statute. If it's post-December 2008, it's not recoverable because they breached by entering into unconsented to unauthorized settlement agreement.
Can I ask you one more date? When was the lawsuit filed? After the reservation event?
The lawsuit was not filed until March of 2009.
Okay.
3 months after the unauthorized settlement.
Okay.
I will reserve for no questions right now. I'll reserve those to my time for rebuttal.
That's fine, thank you. Mr. Conley, whenever you're ready, sir.
Thank you, and may it please the court. This court must decide many hard cases. I would submit that our case is not one of them. It is controlled a fortiori by this court's modern cases, such as Freely and Nunn. Travelers instead relies on a 1937 decision in Kessinger that, if you listen to Mr. Wheeler, was as venerable as Margaret versus Madison. It has guided the bench and bar for 75 years. It has provided a foundation of our legal jurisprudence. Let me respond to that by saying, not once in these 75 years has this court ever cited Kessinger. Kessinger was not even decided in terms of on the merits back in 1937. It relied simply on an implication back then that if you violate a condition of an insurance policy, you forfeit coverage. And yes, it is a forfeiture. This court has talked about forfeiting coverage. Justice Marquez's comprehensive opinion just earlier this year in Pratt laid out the evolution, the history of the prejudice rule in Colorado. And it laid it out in the first time it was addressed mildly, it was in the Moritz case in 1981. But this court in Freeland, Justice Thomas' opinion, overruled Moritz. And over the dissent of Justice Corliss and Justice Coates at the time said, there's no good justification for overruling a 1981 opinion that has its roots back to a 1907 opinion in the Barclay case that has been cited time and again. But this court rejected that argument. The majority said, no, we're going to follow a prejudice rule. We're not going to impose a forfeiture of coverage. And again, let me emphasize, this would be a forfeiture of coverage. This indisputably, although Travelers denied it for many years, comes on this court now indisputably as a covered claim. Travelers denied coverage, and his own insurance agent who's here in court, Ms. Devins, admitted under oath, page 795 of the trial transcript, that he denied coverage of the claim in September of 2008. Justice Francis, you asked about the timeline. Let me explain the timeline to the court. And let me also, before I do that, say that this is a case that was tried to a jury, and there were findings of fact made by the jury. And the jury made five specific findings, all of first Travelers. First, and two findings went to this. Did Travelers act unreasonably towards its insured stress time? Answer, yes. Did Travelers deny StressCon's claim prior to
the settlement? Can I ask you about that? Because the jury verdict forms us, did Travelers act unreasonably pursuant to instruction number 12?
That's finding one, yes.
Okay, so tell me what instruction number 12 said.
Yep, the finding one, yes, that. I understand, Your Honor. Finding 22 are related, because finding one said did it act unreasonably in denying the Mortensen damages,
yes.
And that was in terms of instruction 12 said, that the Mortensen damages were the claims, the damages that StressCon owed to Mortensen. Finding two said that it acted unreasonably in denying StressCon's claim, and it talked about it in instruction 13.
Right.
And that was in terms of StressCon's claim for its own damages that it incurred in terms of increased delay of its own costs. So findings one and two went to did it act unreasonably in denying payments to StressCon. Finding one would have been money that StressCon owed in Mortensen settlement, and finding two would have been funds of stress kind of occurring.
I guess the question that I had actually, Mr. Conley, is a little bit more specific. Were instructions 12 and 13 element type instructions?
No. They just said, instruction 12 said these are just the damages that had occurred in the settlement.
Okay.
No elements in terms of that. But in terms of findings 1 and 2, they go collectively to did the Travelers act unreasonably towards stress kind? The answer on both was yes. And then finding 3, you had to allocate the damages in terms of different categories. Finding four was a key finding. It said, was Travelers prejudiced by the settlement? And Justice Hill, you asked my colleague, Mr. Wheeler, was Travelers prejudiced? His argument is yes. That's directly at odds with what the jury found. And I submit that at this point in the case, the court has to accept the finding that Travelers was not prejudiced. It's a finding of fact. And this court's case is freezing. And every other case, in terms of notice prejudice rule, say this is a question of fact. And they were properly instructed and arguments were heard about how were they prejudiced. Was the liability clear? Did StressCon clearly owe liability more? Answer, yes. you know, with the damages properly allocated, and that was tried. And then the court said, and the jury found that $400,000 of those damages were properly incurred.
So you're going to move on to number five, because that's where I have a question.
Okay.
So the next one says, the travelers denied StressCon's claim prior to StressCon settling with Wortonson.
Yes.
Could you tell me your understanding of that in light of this timeline that I just discussed with Mr. Wheeler?
Yes, I think the jury found that in fact, prior to the settlement in December of 2008, prior to that settlement, travelers had in fact denied StressCon's claim.
And was the evidence that you were relying on for that the reservation of rights?
No.
What was the evidence that you were relying upon?
Yes, including the testimony of Ms. Nemes. So the history of this is July of 2007, the accident occurs. For over a year from then, StressCon is forwarding through its broker, Mr. Hensley, is forwarding to StressCon forwarding to travelers Wortonson's claim. Wortonson is providing documentation, and there's really no dispute that travelers or the StressCon did owe this liability to Wortonson. It was a contractual liability, but they did have to reimburse them for the cost of the delay to the project caused by this tragic accident. And so there were clearly damages that StressCon clearly owed, and in that time period, Wortonson was demonstrating and documenting those damages, providing thick volumes, and the testimony was a banker's box full of documents. Of the damages that occurred, and it was delineated. Morrison had claimed that it had incurred $1.4 million worth of damages as a result of that. So there was some argument that it occurred that or not, but the key point is that at no point in that time did travelers ever indicate a willingness to talk about adjusting that claim. In fact, the testimony was clear, their own agents testified that, they denied that claim. And they denied it because they believed there was no coverage under the policy. And this is their reason. They have twofold reason. They said, one, the liability arises in contract. We're only liable for tort claims. And that was held wrong by Judge Hoffman, and there's no dispute now that in fact they do owe liability, even though the liability arose in contract. It arose as a result of an occurrence, an accidental occurrence, and it was property damage covered by the insurance policy. So there's no dispute about that. So they denied coverage because they said, one, we don't know what because it arises in contract. And their denial letter, there was a letter denying to Mortensen. They said, there's no liability here because there's no tort claim at that. That was too narrow focus because it was clear contract liability and that was clearly covered. So they abandoned their insured next. They also believed wrongly that there was simply an excess insurer. They believed that they did not have any obligation to insure until other insurers stepped up and covered. That again was wrong. And the testimony trial by an insurance expert credited by the jury, Mr. Allen, insurance expert put out by the plaintiffs, that in fact this is not excess insurance and that they have an obligation to step up and pay the claim and then they can go chase other insurers. What they required the insurer to do is to pay the claim out of his own pocket, out of their own pocket, and then chase coverage. And that's exactly what the insurer StressCon did when they filed a suit in May of 2009. So that is so the timeline, Your Honor. The accident happens in 2007. For over a year, StressCon is saying to travelers, here's the claim. We got to pay it, and they're not paying it. And they're refusing to consider paying and consider adjusting. And that's where those testimony in terms of was unreasonable and bad faith from the insurers at first. That they're refusing to adjust it because of their legal mistaken views that we don't owe a contract liability, we don't have to cover, and we don't have to cover because we're an excess insurer. Those two wrongful judgments and mistaken judgments that as a matter of law now have to be accepted are what guided their actions here and inactions. And then finally, the final straw came in October of 08. October of 08, there's pressure being made in terms of we've got to settle this case. It's now over a year old. We're going to have a meeting with all the insurers and all the parties. Let's get them all at the table and try to get this complex complex fight resolved short of litigation. Travelers said, we have no interest in participating in that because we don't want to communicate to anyone that we are going to participate in a settlement. So they refused to participate in the settlement meeting. That's in October of 08. Then the settlement, then finally, after all these efforts proved fruitless, StressCon has to step up to the table and its own money, own volition, has to settle the case in December of 08. Now, in terms of, so that they had a chance, in terms of, let's compare this case to Freeland. Freeland's a case in which travelers had no notice that there was even a claim. The insurer in that case settled a claim that they never even notified travelers about for $20 million. This court, and so for Fitz and Wheeler to say it's just a notice claim, it's a claim that violated every aspect of the insurance policy. And it's a much tougher case, and I can understand, quite frankly, why it was accepted. It's a tougher case. An insurer is told, settles a case for $20 million, comes to its insurer, and then says, oh, pay up, and the insurer says, what claim? What are you talking about? We never even heard of that. Here, in contrast, you had over a year for the insurer to step up and do the right thing. For over a year, they had the opportunity to consistently fail and consciously refuse to participate in settlement because they believed wrongly for the two reasons I discussed, that they did not own an obligation to cover settlement. So, and I think if you're looking at it right on a clean slate, I think there'll be a very easy way to say, in Friedland, Travers can win, but once they've lost in Friedland, I don't think there's any way to say that they could properly win in this case. There's clearly much more prejudice to an insurer to say that we're going to settle a case without even telling you about the claim, rather than here, after you refuse and deny coverage, we are going to step up in an overvolition settle a case. And what the insurer did here is precisely what this court said an insurer can do in a none case. And in this case, it's even stronger than none, because in none, as the court may know, it was a stipulated settlement. So the insured and the third party entered into a stipulated settlement in which the insured was relieved from any liability. And then the third party chased the insurance. Here, the insured, StressCon, paid its own funds and put itself at risk, and then had to choose its own funds to chase down the insurer. So this is a much easier case than Travelers. It's a much easier case than none. And the reason in both those cases compels the conclusion that StressCon was entitled to do and acted appropriately in doing what it did, and did not forfeit coverage. Yes, it would be a forfeit coverage because it's clearly a covered claim. And yes, it would be a windfall for the insurer because they would be avoiding coverage that they should have stepped on and paid. Now we're talking 7 years ago. So for 7 years, they've had the benefit of not paying the insurers that they should have paid in LA. And so to now hold that there was a forfeiture because of violation of the no voluntary payment clause would be an excessive penalty on the insurer, and one that's at odds with this court's reason of Friedman, odds with none. And given Friedman and none, we submit that any contrary implication of Kessinger from 75 years ago cannot stand the test of conduct. Kessinger, again, as I said, was not a holding that the prejudice rule does not apply. It was simply an understanding that there was a prejudice rule. That was just a backdrop of the case, because in 1937, there was no notice prejudice rule. In this jurisdiction, there was no notice prejudice rule until 2001, when Your Honor's opinion in Clementi first said in UIM policy that we're not going to do an automatic forfeiture, we're going to require the insurer to show prejudice. So for Kess to say that, well, Kessinger, we have to follow Kessinger, this kind of dusty old case that's never been cited for 75 years, when it doesn't withstand the test of time under Friedland and under Clementi, I submit there's no justification for that.
Mr. Connolly, may I interject?
Yes, sir.
If you want to finish.
No, I'm very
quick. So can you give me some examples of ways in which an insurer could show actual prejudice resulted from an unauthorized settlement if we were to adopt your position?
Yeah,
how would that look?
Yep. I could say, first of all, was the liability reasonably clear? The court said in this case it was. Could they have gotten a better settlement? And this is exactly the kind of prejudice. It's really the same inquiry that this court demanded in Friedland, because Friedland, although it was a violation of notice provision, was a case in which a settlement occurred without the insurer having any input. So in Friedland, the court said, we're going to have to adopt a different form of prejudice, and in fact, a presumed prejudice, that does not exist when you're just simply talking about a violation of notice provision. Let's start with a notice provision. If you say, Mr. Wheeler said, well, he gave notice a day late or a month late. In that case, I think this court, under the two-step approach of Chief Justice Wright's order about implementing, would say there was really no violation of the notice provision, and there was substantial compliance with notice. But if you violate notice 5 or 6 months late, but still prior to settlement, the only question is, could the insurer have done something better earlier? In Friedland, there's a different inquiry. The court said the prejudice inquiry in Friedland was the insurer had no opportunity to participate in settlement. So the question is, would the insurer have been able to cut a better deal? Would the insurer have been able to avoid liability? Would the insurer have been able to strike a settlement that was less liability? And it's really the same inquiry in terms of prejudice that you require in none. None is the case where...
Actually, Mr. Conley, yes. Before you move on to none, I'd like to ask you a follow-up about Friedman. Yep. You noted that in that case, we did impose a presumption of prejudice in that context. And I'd have to go back and look at the case, but I wondered whether that presumption flowed from kind of the context there that the insurer was unable to participate in settlement. Should not a similar presumption not apply if the notice prejudice rule applies to the voluntary payments clauses?
Absolutely, should have did. And this court, Your Honor's recollection is correct, in Friedland it did create a presumption of prejudice precisely because the violation resulted in no notice before settlement. And in a Clementi case, when you have just a violation of notice provision, but the insurer has the opportunity to participate in resolving the case, there's no presumption of prejudice. So the presumption applies precisely because the insurer did not have an opportunity to participate until after settlement. So that's the very reason for the presumption. And in this case, there was a presumption of prejudice. And I think the presumption erected by this court is more of a burden of production rather than an ultimate burden of proof. But there is a presumption in applying in this case, and the insured StressCon went forward with proof of trial about why there was no prejudice. And then travelers had this opportunity to say, no, we were prejudiced. And that was a classic question of fact for the jury. And the question was, could they have gotten a better deal? Could they have, and they asked point blank to their adjuster, Mr. Evans, could you have gotten a better settlement had you participated? He said, I have no idea. So, that's kind of a classic way of, I can't carry the burden of proof. They did not try to prove that kind of prejudice. And that's precisely why, in special findings that Chief Justice Rice and I were discussing before, in the special findings, was travelers prejudiced by the settlement? Answer, no.
Okay, so that was the reason for that finding.
Exactly. And it was tried with the presumption of prejudice, and they had the full factual opportunity to try to show prejudice, and they couldn't show it by their own admission. And in fact, then they tried to say, well, the amount allocated to the settlement was unreasonable, and they had that chance to do that. They were held liable for $400,000 plus of the amount of contract damages owed by StressCon to Mortensen. So this was all tried, and that's why I say it's an easier case. I think it's easier on the law for the reason I discussed in terms of it's a better case for the insured than Friedland was. I think it's a better case on the facts, because unlike any case that's been tried before for this court in this context, Kessinger, Friedland, none, there has been a full-blown trial. It's been a seven-day trial with a properly instructed jury, in which a jury found that there was no prejudice to the insurer. Now, their premise ultimately is, let's jettison this seven-day trial, let's presume prejudice that we could not prove to a jury, let's presume it is a matter of law. And there's simply no basis for that, other than this 75-year-old case has never been cited anymore. It didn't even hold, simply an implication, because that was the background rule.
Well, what about this argument that the premiums didn't get a chance to catch up? We ought to apply this prior precedent that goes back to the 30s.
Right. Well, there's no evidence that. That's just insurance industry, and they can say, the premium's going to go up. I think the key to that point is, if the premium's going to go up, it would have been up in 2005, because travelers lost this exact issue in Friedland to this court, and then went back on remand to Judge McMillan and said, but this court only decided, the Supreme Court only decided the notice provision, didn't decide this voluntary payment clause. And Judge McMillan said, yes, it did. That's a clear implication of it. And they lost this case 10 years ago in this court, and they didn't even appeal that in court until this court. So it's going to go up. They've already been held liable in this jurisdiction for 10 years. And I think so. This is simply, I think, kind of the old crying wolf tactics of insurers to say, the reason I submit, and it's, I can make the argument just as well, because it's not in the record, it's just rhetoric. I think the difference in terms of whether it's going to go up or not is, again, tracking Justice Marquez's opinion and the unanimous opinion of this court earlier this year at Kraft, is a difference between extending coverage and adding and interpreting a policy in a way that adds coverage that does not exist and not imposing a forfeiture. And again, in this case, there's no dispute that StressCon claims were covered. The question is, can they get them forfeited because it was allegedly a violation of a no voluntary payment clause? And we suggest the answer should be no. But even on the facts, even if the court were not going to go that far, that's not even that big a step. On these facts, this is a case in which the jury has found that travelers denied StressCon's claim prior settlement. What is an insurer supposed to do at that point? Sit back and say, well, hopefully travel will come to the table at some point, let's get sued and get a big judgment, and hopefully they'll pay it when we know the fact and the testimony was a fact. They are never going to pay it because they say it's a contract claim, and they say we're an excess insurer. So StressCon was left in an untenable position, and it did the proper thing. There's no basis under law, under equity, or any other way to hold StressCon liable for a forfeiture of coverage that it paid previous, $440,000 in the very year of the accident. It paid $440,000, and now they're trying to force a coverage for $400,000 claim that they should have paid 7 years ago. We ask the court on the law and the facts to affirm the Court of Appeals, and I'm happy to answer any questions, but if not, I'll see that about my time. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Coleman. Mr. Wheeler.
If the facts are as Mr. Coleman said, he might have a good argument, but they're not. He said, cited the page in which he said that Mr. Nevins said that Travelers denied coverage. It does not appear on that page. It does not appear anywhere in the record. What Mr. Nevins said was that he denied the claim to Mortensen. The letter that Mr. Connolly is referring to, this is really important. He conceded in his arguments today, as he had to, that up until September of 2008, up until September of 2008, what Travelers was doing was forwarding to the subcontractors, insurance companies, the claims that were being made by Mortensen to StressCon forwarded to Travelers. Pursuant to an agreed plan between StressCon and Travelers, that the way to approach this situation was to put the pressure on the subcontractors, insurers, to step in and handle these cases. Why is that? There were three reasons that were given by StressCon's own CFO, admitted by their own CEO, and specified to in great detail by the agent they assigned to handle the Mortensen claim. Those three reasons are, number one, they had a $1 million policy with an excess policy recovery. It was above that. But they had two personal injury claims, a death claim and a personal injury claim, but not a death claim, as well as an emergency claim. They wanted to get the subcontractors to pay as much of this as they could to preserve that insurance for these other claims. Number two, and this is all testimony of their own witnesses, their officers and their agent. Number two was they were doing this because they, StressCon, wanted to preserve their coverage, both the initial, the primary, and the excess for other litigation that might come down the road, because the excess was for its parent company, which had a lot of other companies, subsidiaries, that was covered by this. And number three, Mr. Helms Hensley, who's the agent, said, we also were concerned about when we come up for renewal, if we had to pay, if Travelers had to pay on this, it would affect the price of our policy. So that was the situation as of September 29, 2008. Exhibit 211 is the letter that Mr. Connolly referred to. That letter was not to StressCon. The letter was to Mortensen. That letter denied the claim to Mortensen, not to StressCon, number one. Number two, that letter in draft form was given to StressCon to review, to edit, to comment on. Their CEO edited the letter. That letter was sent pursuant to agreement with StressCon. StressCon fully understood that it was not a denial of coverage to StressCon. It was a letter to Mortensen pursuant to this plan to get the subcontractors' insurance companies to pay. And their agent, again, their agent assigned, he was called their advocate on the Mortensen claim. He said he understood this was not a denial of coverage. That is his testimony, and there's no way to interpret that letter any other way. And in fact, on page 6 of your brief, Mr. Connolly, for this court, described the letter as follows. In September 2008, Travelers sent Mortensen a letter denying StressCon's liability and stating the subcontractors are responsible. That's the letter that Exhibit 211 says. And the court, the trial court, described their reliance on the correspondence with Mortensen as beside the point. It had nothing to do with the issue of whether there was a denial of coverage. There is no evidence of a denial of coverage.
Okay, counsel, can I just get you directly at this point to address the jury's finding then?
Yes. That's paragraph 5. I assume you mean paragraph 5 of the verdict.
Right, exactly.
The first problem with paragraph 5 of the verdict is there's no finding that that was unreasonable. If you look at paragraphs 1 and 2, there's a finding there of unreasonable conduct. In paragraph 5, there is not. Now, in addition, the question is, and I believe that Chief Justice Weiss asked,
13.
Yes, it's number 13. So let me get the language. In any event, the point is that the instruction simply says to the jury to ask whether there was a denial of the claim. And we don't dispute that in Exhibit 211, that there was a denial of the claim to Mortensen. That was the whole point of that letter. So what paragraph 5 does not do is to find that there was a denial of coverage. It's not find that there was an anticipatory breach. It's not find there was a repudiation. And therefore, it can't stand. That can't sustain the verdict. It can't sustain the judgment. It's insufficient.
Mr. Wheeler, let me follow up over here. It seems like you're asking us to rehash that, the evidence that you presented with regard to that finding. I mean, the finding said, did Travelers deny StressCon's claim prior to StressCon settling with Mortensen? Answer, yes.
Yes.
You're asking us to, are you not? Can you tell me how you're not?
Right. And again, this goes to the difference between denying the claim before 2008 on the one hand, and denying coverage going into the future in 2008. That, again, the way the case was presented and tried to the jury was not being asked in paragraph 5, was there a denial of coverage in 2008 going forward?
So maybe you can just help us understand, what's the difference between denying the claim and denying coverage?
If a denial of coverage is an anticipatory breach, Your Honor. It's saying we are denying that there's coverage that we will not pay today, we will not pay no matter what happens. Even if we defend you at trial and you lose.
You're just plain not
covered. You're never right, you're not covered. Whereas if we deny, and that was the distinction that was drawn, again, from the very beginning in this case, of the denial of claim versus the denial of coverage. That's why there is no evidence of denial of coverage. That's why there is no instruction on anticipatory breach, because there simply wasn't any evidence.
But then Justice Boatwright, may I ask?
Sure.
The instruction or the interrogatory says, did Travelers deny the claim? And that would be true.
Yes.
Yes, they did.
So
really your argument is that they asked the wrong question.
That's exactly right. They asked the wrong question because of the error that the trial court made very early in the case of saying that, in fact, there could be a breach of the policy by the insurer if it didn't, in fact, pay in 2008.
Sure.
What was happening in 2008 was that StressCon was saying, we would like to have our claim paid now because we're suffering potential loss of business.
Mr. Wheeler, can I follow up on that now? We're ping-ponging here. Did you object to that instruction? Did you tender your own instruction and say, no, the proper word is coverage? Did you ask for that?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, I don't know if we did because so much of what the charge conference was done.
Well, but you're going to preserve it. You've got to preserve it, right?
But I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
But my point is, it doesn't make any difference. My point is that we're not arguing that the instruction is wrong. We're arguing that the instruction that was given and the verdict form that was used have no material effect. That is StressCon's problem, not ours. They could have asked for a jury for a verdict form that said, does the sun rise in the east? If the jury said yes, it would not impose liability. Our claim is, it's simply finding that there was a denial of the claim in 2008. It's not a denial of coverage, and that's crystal clear from the one exhibit that your economy rely on, the one exhibit that's relied on in your brief, Exhibit 211. Nobody has construed Exhibit 211 as a denial of coverage. Not the trial court, not the court of appeals, not anybody has construed it as a denial of coverage. It was a letter to Mortenson pursuant to a plan with StressCon. It was a denial of the claim. And that's what it says on its face, that's what the testimony is, and that's why StressCon asked for that jury instruction and that verdict.
Let me ask, did you preserve this argument by offering an instruction that talked about coverage or an objection? I mean, is there, I feel like this is a little bit of a game of, hey, you used the wrong term. I mean, to be honest with you.
Well, no, Your Honor. We had tried throughout the course of the trial, from summary judgment all the way through, to persuade the district court of what we believe is clearly the law, which is that we had no duty before the settlement, and that the only way they could get this to the jury would be if they were alleging a denial of coverage, an anticipatory breach. They tried to get that instruction, and the court didn't give it. So we know that they tried. And so from our point of view, all this did was to present a very situation that we said should never have occurred in the very beginning of the trial.
So you feel like you did preserve that?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? I'm sorry, Mr. Wheeler, your time is up.
Thank you.
All right. This case will be submitted. Mr. Wheeler, thanks very much. And Mr. Connolly, we appreciate your arguments today. Let's see, we're going to be in recess till 1:30.